Good evening. Welcome to the Celery Report. Today is Thursday, November 17th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight is my last night in the San Francisco Bay Area. I've been working here from the Sealane Advisory offices and having an absolutely fantastic time. Then I'm headed tomorrow to Europe, first Switzerland and Austria. I'm going to be meeting with people in a variety of fields, but particularly investment, and I'm very eager to find out what's going on in Europe from a European point of view, so I'm very much looking forward to that 2.5 weeks in Europe. Tonight, Dr. William Tiller, Professor Emeritus of Material Sciences from Stanford University, author of many books, I'm working my way through some of them. We're going to be talking tonight about the scientific support for the power of intention, and this information is very paradigm shifting, so I think you're really going to enjoy it. My theme tonight is embracing uncertainty. You know, it's very important. I keep talking to people who've been unduly influenced by others who are convinced that the world is coming to an end, and if history has shown us anything, that the fact that my world is coming to an end does not mean that the world is coming to an end. If there's any lesson of history, particularly recent history, it's that life goes on. I put up a quote last week from Hazel Henderson, and I want to read it to you because it's just perfect for our situation. She said, and for those of you who know her, she's a marvelous person. If we can recognize that change and uncertainty are basic principles, we can greet the future and the transformation we are undergoing with the understanding that we do not know enough to be pessimistic. Great quote from Hazel, but I think that is the case. There are people who do very well during change and uncertainty, and others who literally their field falls apart, and so they fall apart. And part of the world we're in is learning how to adapt to that change and uncertainty. Money and markets. Gold continues to emerge as the center of the new global currency system. From the Wall Street Journal in London, we read. Let me just read it to you. Total central bank gold purchases in the third quarter more than doubled from the second quarter and were almost 7 times higher than a year earlier as countries continued to diversify reserves. At 148.4 metric tons, gold buying among central banks was at the highest since the sector became a net buyer of the precious metals in the second quarter of 2009. This is a quarterly report from the World Gold Council. Central banks and other official institutions, by comparison, had bought 66.5 tons of gold in the second quarter and 22.6 tons in the third quarter. So they are opportunistic buyers. Big video, and I put it up on the blog, of Gerald Celente, very upset about losing six figures in the MS Global situation. The moral of the story is not, as Celente seems to imply, that the system is going to collapse or you're going to lose your money. What is true is that you have to be extremely careful about your custodian relations. If you have securities in the system, where are those securities and what is your evidence of ownership? One of the reasons that I always advise people never to have more than 50% of their assets in one place is, among other things, for this reason. What you never want to do is have your custodian be a company that's engaged in large proprietary trading, because then there are numerous conflicts of interest between their trading positions, particularly if they're highly leveraged, and their ability to perform as custodian. So this is another reason why I prefer custodians whose business is custodian and not proprietary trading, and are very committed to their business model is commitment to their retail investors. The thing to understand is, you know, the market is not clearing based on competition and performance for the customer. We're in a politically managed situation that has huge collateral shorts and frauds in it, and so we're really seeing competition in the world of economic warfare as, you know, the guy who gets caught short on the collateral fraud, which I suspect but could not prove yet that as what happened to MS Global, certainly I think what happened to Bear Stearns and Lehman. But what you're watching is, you know, whether you want to call it a global pin the tail on the donkey or musical chairs, you know, chairs keep getting pulled. And if you look at the financial capacity. There's way too many firms, too much capacity. And so the question is, you know, you're going to have to prune. And rather than prune with market economics, we're going to prune with economic warfare. One way or another, you've got to prune. And so you just need to understand that there are different business models, and ideally you'd like to be custodian with somebody that's the bread and butter of their business model and serving the retail customer as opposed to proprietary trading. One of the things I'm always stunned at is when somebody tells me they're banking because at a particular institution because they get a higher interest rate. I can assure you my bank does not pay the highest interest rates. It's uniformly towards the low end, but I also believe if the day should come that, you know, we get a real bank run or bank crash, they're going to be the last one standing, and that's what I want. And, you know, I don't want to use the institution as a backbone of my transactions, you know, for the last little tenth of an interest rate point. So it's very important when you use an institution to be your transactional backbone or your custodian, you understand what it is you're trying to achieve, and price sensitivity should be within that, but not take you outside those lines, because pruning is going to happen. We're watching a picture emerge in Europe. I keep saying, this is a financial coup d'etat. This is not a crisis. It's certainly not a financial crisis. And as we watch another, you know, member of the Trilateral Commission get anointed, you know, it's beginning to look like a takeover at the Trilateral Commission. I put an article about that up on the blog that's interesting. But as I said before, this is a reengineering, not a financial crisis. At the same time, I've been very frustrated and eager to get over to Europe because I think it's, no matter, I feel I can see the gist of it from this side of the Atlantic, but I also think I'm going to get a much deeper picture over there. One of the things the Europeans are grappling with is the same here now that you've shifted the money. You've promised the baby boomer, you know, a world of benefits, and you kept promising them that as they kept delivering cash into you for your governmental or corporate purposes, and now that they want the cash back as they're retiring, you know, somebody's got to say, oops, guess what, it's gone. And so the question is, how do you let the baby boomers down easy? And trying to find a politician who can do the financially accurate thing while still enjoying political support. Well, that's what I said last week. It's what Bill Cosby said about a medic, the life expectancy of a medic from the time he hits the water to the time he almost gets to the beach is 7 seconds. So, of course, the Trilateral Commission solution for that is, who needs democracy? You know, it's much better to have a friendly dictatorship that just delivers the message. So so we're watching a reengineering. It's going to be very interesting to watch. Of course, whether it's the MF Global situation, what's going on in Europe, we have just an endless stream of people predicting the end of the world. And, you know, I just don't think that is going to happen. I think the stock market, the equity markets are going to perform in a channel. And, you know, we're going to keep seeing wild pumping and dumping within that channel for the year. A very sort of, oh God, just when you think it can't get worse, a very dire article from Will Thomas, one of the top experts on global spraying, on nanoparticles, and it's worth reading. I posted it up on the blog. If you haven't studied chemtrails or global spraying, I really encourage you to listen to the series of three that we did, along with the one from Dr. Gwen Scott, naturopath, who can really help you understand the sort of how to protect yourself physically from the impacts of chemtrails. But if you study the nanoparticles, what it basically says is, if you think smart meters are a problem, it looks like the powers that be want to turn our entire body into a smart meter. You know, so it's very unpleasant, but there it is. I do think it's important. Thrive, the documentary Thrive, premiered on Friday, big premiere out here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I had the opportunity to be there. And of course, the documentary is available at thrivemovement.com. You can buy the DVD or stream it. Given the nature of this documentary, it's 2 hours long. I strongly recommend you order the DVD. One, you're going to want to watch it more than once. But as well, you're going to want to watch it with others. And the richness of it is being able to stop, start, think about it. It's a lot to digest. It's really very, very well done. It's beautifully produced, beautifully scored. Many, many years of very hard work has gone into this. I wrote a review and posted it up on the blog. We sent out a special update. But it's really the best synthesis of sort of problems and solutions I've seen yet. It does not limit itself to the socially acceptable topics, because, in fact, if you look at real solutions, you have to get into issues like what technology has been suppressed, and that gets you into all sorts of subjects which are considered to be, you know, the powers that be don't like us talking about it, and they do a very good job of making somebody out who talks about what are the issues behind UFOs or free energy out to be. You know, derision is used to stop those conversations. Anyway, it's really remarkable, and I recommend strongly just buy the DVD and set some time aside to enjoy it and certainly enjoy it with people you want to have a conversation about, because it's really a great opener for a lot of different conversations. We've also posted the video Investment Strategies for Changing Times. It's been streaming for subscribers for free, and will continue to do so, but now the general public can buy the DVD, and we hope to have it streaming for the general public sometime next week. You know, on these things, we like to make sure you get it first. The goal of Investment Strategies for Changing Times of the presentation was to give my philosophy is only you can govern your assets, whether it's your money or other assets. And really in this environment, we need a framework to help us govern assets. And there is a way to govern them and manage within the change that's happening and within the volatility. And the whole point of this was to help you get that kind of framework and get to the point where you can feel confident that you can manage your assets. There's an article that will go up on the blog tomorrow in Yahoo Finance today. Bill Miller, one of the great legendary money managers in the mutual fund area, retires, has announced his retirement from Legg Mason. And it really is the end of the era as mutual funds are getting squeezed on one side by the ETFs and the hedge fund on the others. And if you look at that squeeze, as well as what's happening with pension funds, they're being squeezed by political control. Instead of fiduciary obligations, I think it all augurs for greater instability within the investment world and greater volatility, but that can work to your advantage if you can see through it too, is what Franklin Sanders calls the primary trend. So if you haven't had a chance to watch that, I recommend it, because I think it's a very good overview of a framework for approaching successful investment in this day and age. Ask Catherine a couple great questions. I've been investing in storable food and blah, 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 blah. What do you think of storable food? I tend to stockpile non-perishables. I tend not to stockpile perishables. I do buy my meat in quarter and half calf, so I tend to have a fair amount of frozen meat ahead of time. What I do for sort of emergencies is I buy a bag of organic oatmeal and a bag of 50-pound bag of organic rice, and I cycle them every 6 months. And so I have plenty of provision for my disaster recovery kit. I do have some freeze-dried food, but only because the law requires me to have a disaster recovery kit. I assure you, if I had to live more than 2 weeks on freeze-dried food, I'd, you know, the worst things than death, and that's probably one of them. So I tend not to have a lot, but and also raw organic honey lasts forever. So I kind of feel between oatmeal, rice, and organic honey, I can live for 6 months if I need to on that. Neither my husband nor I are currently contributing to our company 401k plan. We're buying gold and silver. What else? What else very much depends on your unique situation, but I'm not somebody who believes that you can't have money in real things through investment in stocks and bonds. So I wouldn't limit yourself to just gold and silver coins that you have. I also think gold and silver in depositories in other jurisdictions is a great idea. Another question about Cliff High's predictions. Please do not I know there are wonderful people who think the end of the world is shortly coming, but I really, this is why I would watch the video, because I talk about the different scenarios, and one of the scenarios, is collapse. I give that a small probability. I think the greatest risk we all fear or we all face is debasement of the currency and debasement of our time and assets, and I go into that in the video. So I really recommend to the person who asked this question, I would recommend watching the video. One of the things I talk about is the importance of finding a good food system. So even if you live in the city, see if you can't find a CSA. And I really encourage you, we have as a resource to subscribers a list of the food documentaries we recommend. And I strongly, strongly recommend you get a hold of those and watch. After you've watched Thrive and after you've watched Investment Strategies for Changing Times, see if you can't work your way through the food documentary. Because one of the most important things you can ever do for your health is to have a really wonderful sources of fresh local food. More great questions, which I'll talk about in the next Valeria Report, because I want to make sure we have plenty of time for our guests tonight. So you won't be surprised yet again that our hero for the week is the guest that we're having tonight, Dr. William Tiller. Dr. Tiller is a professor emeritus of Stanford University's Department of Material Sciences. He has spent 34 years in academia after working as a physicist with Westinghouse Research Laboratories. He has published many conventional scientific papers and 3 books, and now has more than several books in a different area, a little more experimental area, psychoenergetics. And he's published about 100 papers and 4 books, and we're going to talk about that tonight. Our topic is scientific support for the power of intention. I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Tiller for an hour yesterday. It was absolutely fascinating, and that's why I wanted to finish Money and Markets early and make sure we have plenty of time for Dr. Tiller. Dr. Tiller, are you with us?
I'm here. I'm with you.
Well, I want to thank you again for taking the time to educate me and to make all the wonderful material you've made available through your website and through the internet to us, and for taking the time to be with us tonight.
It was a joy and is a joy.
Why don't we just dive in? I want to see if I'm going to do as little talking as possible, because there's a lot to cover. And
well, I like guidelines.
Go ahead. I'll provide guidelines. If you could describe your background and how you came to as a scientist and a very serious scientist, how you became interested in studying intention and the research that you've done in this area?
Well, I started out as a young man as a poet and disappointed my wife when I morphed into a scientist. And I'm sort of an applied physicist from the University of Toronto, where I did all my degree work and was immediately hired up by the Westinghouse Research Labs, where I spent 9 years doing science of crystallization and thermodynamics, sort of were my prime fields, and became a world-class scientist there, and decided not to continue there. I had a group of about a dozen people, but the next step there would be I'd have to give up my regular science, and I wasn't ready to do that. So I joined Stanford University as a full professor with tenure in 1964. And shortly thereafter, the department chairman that hired me in became in ill health, and I was asked to be department chair, I guess because I had experience managing some people. And so I did that and had a sabbatical and a Guggenheim Fellowship to go to Oxford University in the end of the 60s, And basically, well, during the 60s, my wife and I became daily meditators, and I became interested on the side in a topic which we could call psychoenergetics or parapsychology, the issue connections of the human mind to altering physical reality. And when I picked up a book on the way to the airplane, and it was Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain by Ostrander and Schroeder. I knew a lot about the work, but I was very impressed with all that was going on in the Soviet Union at that time relative to this work. And I started having the internal mental question, how might our universe be constructed in such a way that would allow this crazy-seeming kind of stuff to naturally coexist with our conventional science that I was doing with my PhD students at Stanford every day. And although I started when in England on the path I had said I would do for the Guggenheim folks, which was to write a couple of books in the science of crystallization, and I started and pursued that for about a month, but I kept having this thought in my head about the issue of how the universe might be created to allow this far-out stuff to somehow be able to connect with orthodox science. And I decided to try to find out, and did this via meditating each day with my wife for an hour, holding the brick of that particular question, and then working all day trying to understand some measure of enlightenment and see if any serious experimental work was violated. So it's like a sculptor that puts a mold of clay on their board and makes some few quick slashes at it, and you get a shape, and then day by day you whittle it with your craft. And that puts a final form on it. Well, it took me actually 6 months every day doing this. And at the end of that time, I at least had a model, a working model that would allow these two to naturally coexist. But the key insight was that if you wanted to have any chance of these things joining, you had to not be limited by distance time. In essence, you had to look for things beyond distance time. And so I thought, well, this stuff is really pretty interesting and terribly important for the future of humanity. And I thought I would get someone else that I could talk someone else into doing it seriously, and finally realized that I couldn't and I had to do it myself. In order to have the time to do that, because I wanted to stay at the university and I needed that job to feed my family, I basically had to find the time, and I did it by giving up all my power positions. I gave up being department chair, asked someone else to take over. I gave up my government committees. I gave up my professional committees. And then I had a block of time that I could use to do this other. And I divided it into three smaller boxes. One was the continued experiential development of self. And the second third was to continue to ask the question, how might the universe be constructed? That is a richer model than the one I had in hand. And the third third was to design and conduct experiments to keep the theory honest. And I've been doing that for 40 years, outside the university generally.
Now, what was the reaction of your colleagues when you told them that this was
They were not happy. Not happy at all. They wanted to make an intervention to remove this craziness or illness or whatever it was they fancied had come over me. But I was pretty convinced I was doing the right thing. And the university was kind enough to allow me to continue holding and enriching this particular set of thoughts. which I was happy to talk to people about if they were interested. Generally, they weren't interested. It's just they couldn't imagine how it could possibly be. If I started to talk to them about some of our experimental data, their eyes would roll after a little while and they'd sort of lose consciousness. it's the way it is. Uh-huh. So
now,
this is the,
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, you want me or you?
Well,
okay,
no.
The thing I wanted to say was that Orthodox science has done a great job getting us off the dime, okay, over the last 400 years, moving away from theocracy into classical mechanics and then quantum mechanics and such. But it's looking for always looking for internal self-consistency with respect to a reference frame. And the reference frame is distance time. I mean, even quantum mechanics and relativity theory, they are framed in distance time. And these other categories of phenomena in nature, I can say parapsychology, but let's just say humans, human consciousness, human intention, human emotion, human mind, human spirit, these do not appear to be distance-time related phenomena, at least not in the way our Orthodox science has been over these last 400 years. And
so if
naturally,
I said they're non-local, is that correct?
They can be non-local. They can be local, but they also can be non-local and thousands of miles away, in fact. So, your turn.
Well, tell us, in 1997, you received funding to finally do some pretty significant experiments, and I thought maybe you could describe that experiment.
Okay. Well, the earlier experiments were also very important, and it proved to me that this category of phenomena was real and that it could be captured in experiments. And I wrote about that in my first book, Science and Human Transformation, Subtle Energies, Intentionality, and Consciousness. But in 1997, I met a gentleman from the Minnesota area, and he was willing to put up 3 years of serious funding in which I could do some experiments. And there was this experiment I'd always wanted to have the opportunity to do. And it goes back to Orthodox science. In the early days, the early 1600s, Descartes had an assumption that he thought was necessary to be put in place in order to try to separate the category of theocratic things, you can call them religious things, from physics-type things, physical reality-type things. And so he proposed an assumption, and that is that no human qualities of consciousness, intention, emotion, mind, or spirit can significantly influence a well-designed target experiment in physical reality. I didn't really believe that at an intuitive level, and I thought, if I ever get some serious money, I'm going to test it. And I did get that in 1997, a three-year program with six people. And so what I did was I carefully designed, with the same degree of care that I did with my PhD students at Stanford, I carefully designed four uniquely different target experiments. And then I was going to set them up, run background information, and then I was going to apply intention to the experimental site. Well, I didn't want to use humans, because humans generally, although they can do these things, they are generally somewhat unreliable and not reproducible. They don't really make good electrodes. But I knew by that time from the work that I had done that there was a simple electrical circuit that I could put in a box 7 inches by 3 inches by 1 inch kind of thing. And I could imprint that simple circuit from a deep meditative state with three other people. The box
so
is really
humans were creating the imprints.
The humans were creating the imprints. Basically, it was a kind of electronics that you might have got at Zach Electronics or Radio Shack in the 1950s. So it's not super stuff that's being done today by Intel and others. It has an EEPROM in it, a memory device, and it has a bunch of quartz oscillators, and it has diodes, capacitors, resistors. That's about it. The radiated electric power seems to be of the order of a millionth of a watt. Okay, not much poop as we think of it. And so what we did was to imprint this device. I called it an intention host device, but it had to be imprinted. And that actually I got four of them and imprinted one for each experiment. A different imprint statement. I always wrote the imprint statements, and we would place it on a tabletop around four well-qualified meditators would sit. People with serious meditation experience for the order of 30 to 40 years. Go into a deep meditative state, connect with each other, connect with the unseen cosmos, and then basically, once people were attuned and felt very coherent with respect to each other, I would give the imprint statement. And the first part of the imprint statement was to activate the indwelling consciousness of the space. And then I would go on to ask that it be lifted, in fact, to a higher gauge symmetry state than our normal reality. And then I'd go to the particular imprint statement. So generally, such a session would take a half an hour to an hour. We had a sub-imprint statement, which was to seal a primary imprint in the device. I've written all about this protocol and such in my second book, which I wrote after these 3 years. It's called Conscious Acts of Creation, The Emergence of a New Physics. And so the four experiments, two of them were inorganic materials, and two were organic materials, one of which was living. And the issue was to change the chemical nature of each of these materials without adding any chemistry in a tangible way, only through this meditative intention statement way. The first was to take water. We start with purified water, let it come to in equilibrium with air. And the first imprint statement was to increase the pH of the water, the acid-alkaline balance, by one full pH unit with no chemical additions. Our measurement accuracy with a digital system was about one plus or minus a hundredth of a pH unit. Now, one pH unit, if you're doing this on your own blood or someone's blood, it's okay if you take it out of the body and do it. That's one thing. But if it's in the body and you're trying to do it, well, a half a pH unit up or a half a pH unit down, you're dead on both ends. One pH unit is a factor of 10 difference in hydrogen ion concentration. So if you're going to increase the pH, you're going to reduce the hydrogen ion concentration by a factor of 10. That's a big chemistry change. We found the experiment was robustly successful. We then did the same with the same kind of water, same treatment. We decreased the pH by one full pH unit with no chemical additions. Again, robustly successful. The third experiment was an in vitro, that is outside of the body, liver enzyme called alkaline phosphatase. And the issue here was, I should backstep a little bit, when you're doing this kind of experiment, what we do is once we get the background, we just place this imprinted device within 6 to 12 inches of the running experiment, plug it into the wall and switch it on and just wait for the change. It generally takes quite a while for the change, but it does come. And it's always in the direction of the imprint statement. So back to the alkaline phosphatase. In this case, during the process, you are actually lifting the symmetry state of the space beyond our normal reality, which is called the U1 gauge state. And we like to lift it to what's called the SU2 state. This is just jargon. And in doing this, we found, and the intention statement was to increase the chemical activity of this liver enzyme significantly. And what we did was we left it in this higher gauge symmetry state space for 30 minutes, and we were able to increase the chemical activity of ALP, this alkaline phosphatase, by 30%, and with a p-value of better than 0.001, which is a very significant result. The fourth result was a living system, and a fruit fly larvae. And so we set up our protocols in this case, and the intention was to increase the energy storage molecule, ATP, relative to its chemical precursor in the cells, ADP, as much as possible without harming the organism. With the idea being that if that happened, then the larvae would be more physically fit and they would more quickly mature to the adult fly stage. So the experiment was run with in this higher gauge symmetry state space for its entire life. And we found that we were able to increase the ATP to ADP ratio by about 15 to 20%. And the larval development time was reduced by about 25%. And again, with both cases, the p-values were better than 0.001. Remarkable
now,
results.
Some of these were done at great distance, correct?
The initial imprinting wasn't done at great distance, but we, in order to get reproducibility, to show that we could get reproducible results, we did some of them in London, some of them in Milan, and more recently, we have found that we can have this happen by broadcasting using another kind of energy and another kind of information channel than electromagnetism. But we've broadcast most recently to a particular building, actually a particular room in a particular building on a particular street corner in Berlin, Germany. That was about 6,000 miles away. And we have used that kind of broadcasting technique to change other properties. In one case, supplement for humans, a group of proteins to help the immune system of humans. And another to reduce about, that one was about 100 miles away, and in a factory. Third one, most recently, was to imprint a device to significantly reduce the humidity and broadcast it to a person's home down on Buzzards Bay, where in the summer it is incredibly hot and incredibly humid. And we were able to, at least in our site in Payson, Arizona, we were able to reduce the one that's broadcasting by 50%. The one down there had its technical problems. in that it was on an island and didn't really have access to the web. When you want to monitor something at a distance, we need access to the web. So that's basically, we have been pursuing this sort of thing now for 13 years. We have been able to broadcast at a distance to people with serious depression and anxiety problems, and just using their name and address, scroll through a computer, and beside the computer is this intention imprinted box. And we, after 8 months, we found both were successful with p-values better than 0.001. So it says, go ahead. Your turn.
One of the best things that came in on the webinar software was, can Dr. Tiller describe his experiments with reconnective healing?
No, it's okay. I mean, basically, the experiments in that particular case, visualize a teacher on a platform, and students in the audience listening to the description of the healing, that particular healing process, before doing kind of a hands-on workshop aspect. And we were in the room sitting out of the way with our detector. We have learned how to measure these things. That is, in the room, we can measure the lift to the gauge symmetry state of the space using our pH detector and quantify it in terms of millielectron volts up, etc. And so the first time we did this, we found that it was in Sedona, in a hotel. We found that the room was already conditioned to a higher level of reality 7 hours before the workshop even started, which was kind of interesting to us. We learn a lot by doing these experiments because we don't understand what's going to happen when we start. And that, in fact, is an entanglement in time. When we did the Berlin experiment, we found it was entangled in time 1 month before we actually switched on the device in Payson to broadcast to Berlin. It turned out that the Berlin experiment was to increase the pH unit by 1.5 pH units, the pH in the water vessel there by 1.5 pH units. The Berlin experiment actually started increasing the day we were discussing the experiment. A week later, I wrote the imprint statement. Another week after that, we sat and imprinted the device, and a week after that, put it in our Payson site location and switched it on. So,
could you explain what you mean by entanglement?
Okay, let me start. The interesting thing was the very first time we imprinted a device. Okay, for some reason I decided to make a test once it was imprinted. And I took an imprinted device and an unimprinted identical device, separated them by about 100 meters, and switched them both off electrically. And then just waited, about 5 days, I found that the unimprinted device had picked up the imprint from the imprinted device.
Okay.
And I was very dismayed because I thought, my God, goodness, I'm not going to be able to do any experiments. And then I thought, well, the good side was it couldn't be electromagnetic energy. It had to be another kind of energy that was transferring. And it had to be a different kind of information channel that it was transferring through. And then I went through some internal thinking about it and then realized, okay, if I electromagnetism had to be involved. If I wrap aluminum foil.
Dr. Tiller? So while we're waiting for Dr. Tillett, let me just mention we had a long talk yesterday, which is absolutely fascinating. And one of the things, he said one thing, and I'm always amazed when this happens. You get somebody telling you an insight that's so profound, it kind of rocks your world, and you can't last 24 hours. I keep having a desire to just stop doing everything and go off and sit under a tree and think about it. But and part of it was an insight that I've dealt with many times in scripture or in spiritual practice, but I've never had a scientist talk to me about it. And I had asked him about whether or not he had looked at any of the experiments with community prayer and meditation. And what he said was, he said, one of the things that's very important in those kinds of situations is that the individuals involved are highly coherent. And in fact, you get a much better result with a small number of coherent individuals than you do, if you have a lot of individuals who are not coherent. And this very much fits with, if you come to our website, there we have an article called Coming Clean, and we did an audio seminar. If you go back into the audio seminar archives, which all subscribers have access to, there's a very old audio seminar on coming clean and the importance of each one of us sort of cleaning up our own, you know, whether it's our money or our spirit or a living situation, but coming clean within ourselves. And to me, that's becoming a more coherent individual and one who can access the kind of power that Dr. Tiller is talking about. So it's one of the things I was hoping to get him to talk about, if we can get him back.
Catherine?
Anise?
His line seems to be busy.
Oh, dear, I hope he's... he's going to describe this for... Okay, well, let me... hopefully he will come, he will realize that he's not on and come back in. But let me go through some of the other things that I wanted to bring out in the conversation with him. One of the things he talked about with me was the impact of this kind of knowledge and technology on the economy and the potential for... really, in every field, if you think about it, dramatic improvements and sort of productivity across time and space. We also talked about the, obviously, if you can imprint an intention in a electronic form and then use it to target a living system, we talked about the possibilities of abuse of this kind of technology. And I do think this, you know, Adam Trombley and I did a really wonderful audio seminar on entrainment technology and subliminal programming. And I do think that they're using this kind of technology in ways to manipulate and control. And I think that's one of the reasons I very much want you to understand the existence of this kind of technology, because, you know, it can be used to, as Dr. Tiller said, produce depression. It can also be used to create depression, I believe. Another point we talked about that I really wanted to bring out was, I'm going to say it with my words, and I think Dr. Tiller would use different words, but whenever he was working with sort of increasing and improving the energetic level or the mind, if you will, and trying to sort of take a space or a situation into a higher mind, was almost like the universal intelligence would show up. What, you know, I'm a Christian, so I call it the Holy Spirit, but the feeling that there is this intelligence and love in the universe, and when you try and engage in this way, it shows up and it helps you. We are living in a spiritual universe, and that spiritual universe has power. One of the things for the Let's Go to the Movie this week, I had put up Dr. Tiller's PhD, DVD called An Introduction to Intention Host Device. It's about a 42-minute lecture where he walks through the experiment and what he's done. He has another DVD up on his website. It's just William Tiller Foundation. You can pick it up on a search or link to it from the blog post. And he has a much longer one, which I've ordered and am going to watch, but it's one he recommends where he walks through in detail sort of both the research they've done and the ramifications. It was filmed in Denver, and it's 7 hours long. I'm going to do one of my famous Saturday all-dayers with popcorn and iced tea. But you can get those on his website. He also has a series of books. Unfortunately, they're not Kindle-ready, but I've ordered about four of them, and he described the different ones, and they go through the different experiments and his sort of his feelings on what the implications are for these in a wider and more practical way. Well, I think he may not.
Looks like I got you.
Oh, there you are.
My wife's cell phone came to the rescue.
Oh, I was worried that you might not realize that you were that the phone had gone out.
Yeah, I did realize it, and I kept using the same phone, the host phone, because it's better quality, I thought anyway.
Uh-huh.
And I kept having troubles. So in any event, your advice to get another phone, I got my wife's cell phone, and I'm talking on her cell phone. So
we're back together. To have you back. One of the things I was telling them, and I'll tell you now because we have less time, yesterday when we spoke, you said something that completely rocked my world. And it's funny when this happens because ever since you and I talked, I have this tremendous desire to stop doing what I'm doing and just go think about it. And that was, you said, I'd asked you about community prayer and meditation, and you said that the results related to the quality of the coherence of each individual.
Yes.
And that's something I absolutely believe, and it's something I've read a lot about in Scripture, but I've never had a scientist say it to me in that way. And the affirmation of what I believe spiritually, but from a scientist, was very powerful. And so maybe if you could talk a little bit about coherence, I'd really love it.
No, you would like me to say something about the inner work aspect or what? I can get started. You might have to direct me as to what it is you would like to know about, because
about
this is a huge topic.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. The importance of the coherence of the individual in terms of community.
Okay, so let me go through. Let me go through the business of the light bulb example.
Okay.
All right. If we take a 60-watt light bulb, it gives a bit of light, but not a lot of light, and largely because the photons keep interacting with each other in an incoherent way. If you could take the light bulb with that number of photons coming out and arrange them so that they were in phase with each other, then you would have what we know of as a laser, and that for the same number of photons coming out of the light bulb, the surface temperature of the light bulb would be something like 10 times the surface of the sun. Okay, that's one piece of information that's important for people to grapple with, because you see, humans are just like that as well. Most people are relatively incoherent. But if they do inner work on themselves, meditation and such, qigong, all of those sorts of things, then they quiet the noise and the incoherence within self, and they become much more coherent, and they can do very great things within themselves. Qigong masters, for example, can do the kinds of things that we do with our little box. They can do it from 1,000 miles away because they are coherent, relatively coherent inside. And that's really like the experiment we did in Berlin. By radiating from Payson, we conditioned a space in the Berlin site. There was an unimprinted device there. And so we lifted the symmetry state of that device 6,000 miles away, and the higher symmetry state was manifest by radiations in the space that were picked up by a pH monitoring system monitoring a bottle of water or a water vessel. And then we saw the pH change. The issue, let me just go back again to this issue of one pH unit. If one pH unit change is a change of a factor of 10 in hydrogen ion concentration, and it turns out at room temperature, that's in a pH electrode, it changes by 23.6 millielectron volts. If you were to... Okay, so let's just hold on to the 23.6 millielectron volts. If you were to heat the room in order to get the same kind of change, you would have to heat it by 300 degrees centigrade. That would give you the same thermodynamic free energy change as the change of a pH by one pH unit. Are you hearing me? It's remarkably efficient. And of course, one can do much, much better than that. I mean, we have changed pH by 2.5 pH units, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be all a doable kind of thing, and it can be broadcast. My working hypothesis is that we can enhance beneficially every technology that exists in the world today and create new ones. So
we have a whole pile of questions. Can I quick ask you some of the questions we're getting?
Yeah, sure. You go right ahead. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Please ask Dr. Tiller to comment on how we can use intention to affect positive change in our world. Are there practical exercises or just disciplines we can use? Please recommend some teaching learning tools for those who are not scientifically schooled. Many thanks.
Well, I would first suggest that they go to my website, www.tiller.org, and there are a bunch of free white papers there. There's about 22 of them. Number 15 happens to be one for self-health and preventive medicine that people can do for themselves. I think number 16 happens to be the experimental write-up on the depression and anxiety experiment. I think number 18 or 19, someone once asked me if I would write down the affirmations that I use for meditation. And it's there, so you'll find it if you make the effort. Everybody can do these things. Everybody. I mean, this is part of our heritage for all of us. And you need to understand what needs to be understood is that when we do the intention, we are basically changing the properties of the physical vacuum. And it has been calculated by very significant physicists like John Wheeler, who's passed on just recently, that the physical vacuum, in order for quantum mechanics and relativity theory to be internally self-consistent, it must contain latent energy density of 10 to the 94 grams equivalent per cubic centimeter. Now, that's a big number. What does it mean? What it says, if you if you take just a single hydrogen atom, okay, it's one proton and one electron, and the rest of it's empty space. If you take that empty space and you multiply it by this 10 to the power 94, and you convert it, the grams to energy using Einstein's E equals mc squared, then what you find is that the latent energy storage in the physical vacuum, which most people think is nothing because you can't see it, it is a trillion times the energy storage in all the planets and all the stars and all of the cosmic dust in our cosmos, a sphere of radius the order of 15 billion light years. So here we have something that we as a species think of as nothing. And the vacuum is within, take atoms and molecules in our body, get a point on all the fundamental particles that are in each atom. The rest of it is vacuum space. We have such huge potential in our bodies in terms of energetics. If we focus our intention, if we learn to grow our intention, and one of the things that I wish to do is to build a biofeedback device so that people could use that to build their ability to intend. That will happen. You just have to gather the money, that's all. Sometimes that takes longer than shorter. But in any event, everybody can do these things, potentially.
One of the questions is, to initiate our state of thriving, how about boycotting one corporation's core concept every week or meditating positive intentions in small groups? I believe it may be more effective and safer than physical protest.
I would agree. Well, now, one thing to remember in terms, groups are better than individuals, but individuals need to be coherent before groups can be coherent. If you have individuals, you can have millions of them. If they're not incoherent, it's just like the light bulb. So an individual has to make themselves coherent, and then they have to take a group, and they have to build that group to become coherent. And at present time, we really have the tool. We could do this experimentally. We have the tools that could be assembled for people to learn those things.
One of my favorite stories in the Old Testament is the story of Gideon, and the angel of the Lord asks Gideon to call an army, and he calls an army and say, I don't know, 20,000 guys show up, and the angel of the Lord says, no, you know, you got a lot of people, but they're not. He says true believers, or they don't have faith, but what he meant is they're not all coherent. You need to get it down to the ones who are coherent.
Yes.
And it very much parallels what you're saying. Yeah.
I think it does, and it backs up sort of my statement that I said to you yesterday. To me, we are all spirits having a physical experience as we ride the river of life together. Our spiritual parents dressed us in these bio-body suits, which I think of as like a diving bell to go into a strange environment. So those bio-body suits, in order to grow in coherence, in order to develop our gifts of intentionality, and in order to become what we're intended to become, which is co-creators with our spiritual parents. And we all can do that, and all will do that, ultimately.
We have gone a little bit over, and while we were waiting for you to join back in, I did go through the DVDs and books, but I explained the two DVDs, and I've ordered the one you did in Denver, so I'm going to watch that. But if you could just run through the books that you've done on this topic, I would appreciate it, and let people know how to get a hold of them.
The first, you can get all of these things by my website, via PayPal. The first one was in 1997. That was the year's experiments between the 1970s to up till 1997. And that's Science and Human Transformation, Subtle Energies, intentionality, and consciousness. The 3 years that I had funded, that was published in 2001, and that was called Conscious Acts of Creation, The Emergence of a New Physics. The third was the replication experiment, and I think it was published in 2005. That was called Some Science Adventures with Real Magic. And the final one, I think it was published in 2007, and that was Psychoenergetic Science, A Second Copernican Scale Revolution. And they are all accessible on my website, as well as the sort of 23 free white papers. And so are the two DVDs. Sorry, Catherine, are you still there? Yeah, I can hear you. Yep. Sorry, I'm not used to using a cell phone. That was a weekend seminar at the University of Denver with an audience of about 60 or 70 people. And I had one of my friends videotape it. So that became that DVD. Everybody who watches it seems to have great fun with it. So those are the things.
Yeah.
Well, you'll have fun. You'll enjoy it. and it really sort of lays out a lot of the experiments. Some of the recent ones are not yet available because they're under review in various journals. We've even done something with respect to the Maitreya Buddha relics, monitoring their effects on physical reality. So there's a lot there. It ultimately will be our new science, the science of the future, but we have to get Orthodox science community unstuck first. It's pretty wedded to distance time and don't have any real belief that there's anything beyond distance time. And they've fed that to the general public, so the general public have come to believe that they can't do these things, but they can't. And they have to believe, they have to have the desire to do it, and they'll do it.
One of my favorite quotes is when the first time that I introduced this sort of body of information to a very intelligent friend of mine who was initially skeptical, he thought for a minute and he said, if this is true, it means the good guys can win.
Well, it's always choice, and it's always up to us, isn't it? This is a classroom.
Oh, yeah.
One has to get that. It is a classroom. We are basically indestructible at the core level. So,
That is very powerful wisdom, very powerful knowledge. And Dr. Tiller, I feel a little bit like the first time I ever saw Tina Turner in concert. I thought, what's my excuse?
I've looked a little bit at your stuff, and I think you're doing a great job.
Well, your contribution has been revolutionary and is a gift of incredible love and generosity, and we appreciate it, and I'm going to continue to dive into your material, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time this evening to join us.
You're very welcome.
The Larry Report.
And I think the thing that we all need to remember, it is an act of love.
Yeah. It absolutely
is.
Well, you have a wonderful evening, and thank you again.
Thanks.
Okay,
you too,
ladies
Catherine.
And gentlemen, Dr. William Tiller, wonderful scientist, wonderful human being, great work, and I hope you get a chance to really dive and read his stuff because it's incredibly rich. And as I said, I've ordered the Denver DVD, and that's going to be a great Saturday for me in December. Coming up December 1st, I'll be talking to you, to you from Zurich. I'll be talking with Foster Gamble, the writer and narrator of the Thrive documentary. Again, get it in DVD. I think you'll find it really terrific. December 8th, Precious Metals Market Report. I'll be back in Tennessee with Franklin. I'm homesick, and I'll be delighted to see him. And then a very special treat on the 15th, Dr. Peter Dale Scott from California on Deep Politics. Peter is an absolute genius in terms of understanding history, particularly American history. He was a Canadian diplomat, became a Berkeley professor, and started to look into the sort of deeper politics, went into the Kennedy assassination, has a wonderful new book called The War Machine. Extraordinary person. So, and just an incredible group of people in December, Foster Gamble, Franklin Sanders, and Peter Dale Scott. So we're going to have a very, very rich December. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. And as Dr. Taylor has taught us this evening, you know, our conspiracies have great power. Good night and good luck.